is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. My guest, Gail Scott, is a brave and articulate woman, and she was sexually wounded for sure. Her personal trauma to triumph story really is inspiring, and that's why I asked her to be a guest on the program today. Welcome, Gail Scott.
Hi, Diana. It's a pleasure to be here this evening.
Yes. Well, I'm so glad that you're on, and you're very transparent. You want to tell your whole story, and it's got some pretty dramatic and difficult aspects to it. Your personal story highlights you sent to me, and we also talked off the air, and then your success strategies and the tools that you've used. I mean, it's very inspiring. And of course, I hope that, and you probably hope the same thing, that some of what you'll share with us will inspire others and get others to who might have had a sexual abuse or worse to do something, to get some help. So, right?
That's absolutely right. You know, my experience is not unique.
Mm-hmm.
There are many people out there that have experienced very similar things to me, and I see myself as, I see it as a gift, because now I have the ability to be able to share what I've gone through and where I'm at now and some of the things that I've learned along the way to be able to inspire and motivate other people to be able to really understand that no matter what you've come from, you can certainly put it behind you and you can move forward into a much happier and more pleasurable life.
Now, some of our listeners will notice, perhaps, if a Scottish brogue.
Yes,
because
I am.
You were raised in Scotland, weren't you? And now you live in Toronto, Canada.
And, yes, that's right.
Yes. And tell us a little bit about what you are doing now, and then we'll talk about your story highlights and the tools that you've developed to overcome lots of difficulties, including father incest.
Thank you for that introduction. Right now, I am speaking and writing and coaching. I'm helping people understand that no matter what kind of trust issues or betrayal they've experienced in their lives, there's a different way for them to live. They can have a different attitude. They can create new belief systems. They can behave in a different way, which will bring them a very different result in their life. And so I like to take my experiences, my stories, my expertise, my knowledge out to organizations and associations and individuals as well and help them understand the difficult things that we go through in relationships at every level. And so what I like to do is help people understand that family of origin issues don't end when you become an adult. We take them into the workplace where we suddenly find that we have a boss who is very similar to one of our parents, or we take them into our relationships and we find a partner who's turned into one of our, you know, family members.
Right.
And also about struggling with children and how do we communicate with our children around issues that we've had in the past, and especially delicate issues like sex and trauma and things like that.
Again, you've been very brave to do this because you went through a lot. And it's really true, family of origin issues don't end. And when we were speaking off the air yesterday, sort of my pre-interview, I used a metaphor with you which apparently resonated, and it is this, it's scatological. The room may smell like shit, but but you're familiar with the smell, and so that's why you did not always make good choices, because your father had sex with you, including intercourse, and your mother was alcoholic. And so tell us a little bit about that, because that's a harrowing story, really.
It is, and I have to say that growing up in a family like that, and this is my experience of other people who have grown up in these kinds of environments, and it doesn't really matter what the addiction is, it's the same kind of results that come through for everybody.
Yes.
Is that it's what we know. It's what we think is normal. Mm-hmm. It's what we get to believe is the way it is. And so unless we have someone who shows us that it can be different, we will just repeat the past. And so growing up in that kind of family, I really didn't understand the dynamic of what was going on. There was a lot of physical abuse as well as verbal and emotional mm-hmm. abuse. And my coping strategy was to just stay silent. And in family roles, that's called the lost child. There's lots of different family roles that people take on, and I've taught people that too. But for me, my fear was that if I said anything about what was going on, that I would basically be kicked out onto the street. And as a child, it's irrational, except it's a fear. And so coming from that place, we were a very insular family. We had no
yes.
extended family around us. I had no other adults that I could turn to talk about what was happening. My mom at the time was really drinking a lot. My father was working all the time, and some things were going on. My brother was creating havoc in his own special way, and so the physical abuse that was going on made it a very unsafe place for me to speak up about anything. And so when the molestation happened, I certainly didn't feel that I had anywhere that I could go.
Including
the shame and guilt that comes out of that experience just kept me silent
for
a very long time.
So you did not tell your mother then?
I did not tell my mother.
Yeah.
I didn't tell anybody.
Yes, yes. You know, there is strong evidence that the way a mother reacts to what has happened and her attitude to her daughter can have long-term consequences. Your mother's silence, because she may have known on some level, even if you didn't tell her, that
was also... Absolutely. That's entirely
yeah.
possible now.
Yes.
And one of the things that I very strongly remember about my mom was that my mom was deaf in one ear.
Mm-hmm.
And she would jokingly say that she slept on her good ear.
Oh.
And so, I just knew
she
that.
Was deaf.
My mom was... You know, we were provided for in terms of, you know, food and board,
right.
but emotionally and spiritually and in any kind of healthy way, it just wasn't available. And whether she knew or not, I didn't feel safe that I could go and tell her or anybody else for that matter. So I just kept quiet.
Then that results in so much more when you can't tell anybody, and this is very common. I've worked with lots of women who've had sexual abuse, and so it's very common. And then little girls get blamed for being seductive or other things, that she brought it on, and sometimes little girls and boys, because I've worked with boys who've been, men, I'm sorry, who've been sexually abused. But honestly, the bottom line is we should not absolve adults from responsibility for children.
It's so true. I remember in one of my therapy sessions, my therapist saying to me, I had talked a lot about my mother and, you know, the difficulties that I had in my relationship with her, and this was prior to me knowing about, remembering about the incest, and she said to me, well, but what about your father, Gail? What was the relationship with your father? And mm-hmm. to my recollection, I didn't see my father as an adult in the home. Because and her point to me was, he did not protect you. Little did we know at that time that he had actually abused me. So it was a very weird dynamic. My mother was the matriarch, and God forbid you go up against her. And yet my father just kind of, you know, he worked all the time. And so as a child, I just went along with what I thought was normal. It was. Mm-hmm. It seems surreal now to me.
Yes. Yes. As you've sorted through this, but it's helped so much with your healing. So I have read that the profile of an incest family is similar to that of the family of a battered wife. That both mother and daughter are victims of male violence, and I don't know what your mother and father's relationship was like. Was there a lot of fighting between them? I don't know if there was any violence, but
actually, there wasn't. What
there
was
not.
Really confusing was
yeah.
that my father adored my mother.
Uh-huh.
There was never any violence between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a lot of arguing between the two of them. And I know that at that really difficult time when my brother was being very, very much physically abused and the molestation started for me, they were fighting a lot at that time. And my mm-hmm. mother actually tried to leave at one point, and then that was unsuccessful. So they mm-hmm. made a fairly big lifestyle change for us at that time. And they moved us to a different part of the country. And my parents actually bought their own business.
Mm-hmm.
And that business escalated the sexual objectification of me. But unbeknownst to me. And so in terms of the incest family being the same as a battered wife family, the way that I would see the correlation between that is the powerlessness. I believe that there was a powerlessness for my father, not my mother. And
mm-hmm.
so perhaps I was just the battering ram, I suppose, that you could say for his powerlessness in the relationship.
So you gave me your personal story highlights, and you said that the molestation began at age 9.
Mm-hmm.
For you with your dad, and it continued to intercourse at age 13, ending at age 16.
Mm-hmm.
That's horrific. And do you know if this was ever reported? Probably not, since you didn't want to tell anybody.
It was never reported.
Mm-hmm.
I never spoke about it. I never
mm-hmm.
told anyone about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it now because I've done so much personal work and individual
yeah.
therapy to be able to remember these experiences, and my body definitely was telling me that there was something very wrong. And it's only through exploring, journaling, meditating, talking to therapists over the years since I discovered this 5 years ago is that all this stuff came up. And I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't experienced it in my own mind. And the body reaction, the cellular memory of the trauma was so real that it couldn't be not real.
Yes. Quite a few years ago when I co-led two women's sexuality groups for 11 years with Dr. Maria Flaherty and San Jose, California. We worked with a therapist, a body worker, who was very well trained, And so she could be touching a woman who'd been sexually abused in a certain part of her body. I mean, massaging, legitimate massage, right? And it would create all of these memories because the body does remember. The body has these cellular memories, as you say.
Mm-hmm. That's my total experience. That uh-huh. That's what happened with me. And I know that I've met a lot of other people who have come out of, you know, dysfunctional, abusive families, and most of them are suffering from post-traumatic stress. Most of them need a body worker to be yeah. able to take that energy out of the body. And that's what happened with me when I did the pelvic floor physiotherapy. I suddenly was almost time warped back into the room, which was extremely traumatic.
Of course. And you saw the physical therapist who did pelvic floor work. And by the way, in my work now in Seattle, unfortunately, there are a number of these PTs, physical therapists, who do this sort of work. It's essential for women suffering sexual pain, whether it's vaginismus, where penetration isn't possible because of the contraction of the vaginal opening, or vulvodynia, mm-hmm. where it's inside the vagina. And so these women really need to have the combination of talk therapy and physical therapy, and maybe a medical doctor or a naturopathic doctor. So it's sort of a multidimensional approach to female sexual difficulties.
I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, I've learned to create my own health team for myself.
Oh, good for you. Talk more about that, Gail.
So when I first started understanding the family dynamic of what I had come out of, mm-hmm. my body was falling apart. I was in early menopause in my late 30s. I had adrenal burnout. As soon as I started really exploring what was happening to me, I was in a severe depression and went into post-traumatic stress. And I hired a holistic psychotherapist. And so that decision took me down a path of very alternative healing.
Yes.
That meant I didn't go on any kind of antidepressants. I really looked at energy healing and body work and talk therapy of all different kinds, meditation, yes. trance work, all of those things. And then when I discovered about the incest, which just kind of came out of the blue, but it was funny, it came out of the blue to me, but not to other people that knew me. They weren't surprised by that information. That's including my ex-husband. And I realized that I need to really explore this deeply to heal properly. And so I created a team of people to help me to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew I couldn't do it on my own.
Mm-hmm.
Which has been really, really helpful. And so over the last 5 to 10 years, I've worked with all different kinds of practitioners to deal with the emotional trauma that's come out of those experiences.
Well, you're remarkable in that
well, you
have persevered. You had a really difficult beginning, and you didn't really start to pursue all of these helping strategies to help you heal until you were sort of halfway through your life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that was really kind of really mind-boggling because I had gone through a 25-year marriage not understanding what was wrong with me and, in fact, thinking that everybody had pain on intercourse, thinking that everybody, you know, struggled with these same issues that I was struggling with. And it wasn't until I met a group of women when I had my daughters that they basically told me, no, Gail, that's not really normal.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started exploring. Well, my marriage ended when I went through this very difficult time. And then I started really thinking about, okay, well, what does it mean to be a sexual woman? And I started exploring who I was and what I wanted and what I might think about trying and all of those kinds of things. And it was just kind of, I just kept following my nose. It just kept, okay, that showed up. I'll go and do that now. And there was also no real guide for me. I was my own guide.
You were your own guide. You had to be.
Yeah.
And perhaps that also accounts for the fact that your work has been so personally profound and it's made a difference because you've been in charge of your own healing and guiding, and you've been very deeply intuitive and intentional about it.
Mm-hmm. That's so true, and I would find myself meeting people who were helpful to me along the way. I met a friend through a support group that I had joined, and she was also separating from a long-term marriage, and she was going to this particular sex shop to do workshops. And she said to me, "Come on, Gail, you want to come to this? You need to know about these things." And so I started going to some of these workshops, of which I knew absolutely nothing. I didn't buy a vibrator until I was in my mid-40s. And
by the way, had you been able to reach orgasm without a vibrator?
Yes.
Okay.
Easily,
so
myself.
Well, that's good, because I have found that lots of women with sexual trauma and maybe a lack of masturbation in their teenage times, they almost always need a vibrator. But maybe you were able to self-stimulate. I know that masturbation has been a part of your becoming more sexually whole.
Oh, absolutely. It's been incredible. I did masturbate in my teens. I've masturbated my entire life, and mm-hmm. and I've had a lot of success with it.
Yeah, good.
That I would find myself very tense.
Uh-huh.
And though I would be able to reach an orgasm, I would be extremely tense. It wasn't a free climax.
Yeah, interesting, yes.
And so the pelvic floor, my pelvic floor was so constricted and so
right.
tight
mm-hmm.
that I would, and in fact, in my experience, I was terrified to let go. And
of
so I never
course,
really
of
had
course.
Real
Wait,
cool
a pause,
orgasms. Pardon?
Gail, pause for a moment, because I have lots of women. I have had and do have currently in my practice women who struggle reaching orgasm, and so often one of the underlying issues has to do with loss of control, fear of going over the edge and what will happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you talk about that a little
sure.
more?
Sure.
Yeah.
So in my early sexual experiences in my marriage, I really wasn't very satisfied. I would satisfy myself, but it would be almost done in secret, almost
mm-hmm.
done as an afterthought. And
mm-hmm.
it was only because I had all of this desire and these hormones, and I had a libido.
Yes.
But there was no sexual satisfaction in my sex life with my husband at the time. And it was
mm-hmm.
a lot of it was to do with my own tension. And I just could not relax. And when I was separated and I started seeing other men, I found that I had a lot of problems with that. And so I ended up in meditation, because the trauma in my body created panic attacks. I was terrified.
Oh, yeah.
And so when I started doing mindfulness, I would take myself into the situation without physically stimulating myself. And
right.
and process the energy in that way so that I could get used to it. That was how I started.
Mm-hmm.
And then over a few years, I became more comfortable even accepting having an orgasm with a partner, because that wasn't something I was used to.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, I went through a phase where I had a wonderful partner who understood my trauma and basically worked with me to help me to relax even more.
Oh, weren't you fortunate to find that man? Yes,
he was a lot of fun.
Is he still in your life?
But it didn't end there. It wasn't completely solved there.
Oh, right, but it was a step. A step along the way.
It was a step, and when I did the pelvic floor physiotherapy, I also did some healing, some body healing around with tantra work in my sexuality. But after I did the pelvic floor physiotherapy, I chose to take myself through a masturbation practice that would deliberately have me drop into the experience and relax. And that was scary, even though I was doing it myself.
Oh, yes. But then I'm going to guess that the more you did it, the easier it became.
Yes.
Or
yes,
at least it was a little less terrifying.
Well, yeah, because it was pleasurable.
Yes.
But also some of the tantra training that I've done has also helped me to understand the levels of orgasm so that I could manage it better. But that's okay within masturbation. But when I got to be with a partner, I was still dealing with the disassociation and allowing myself to trust someone so that I could relax enough for them to pleasure me.
And so your work, and people, and I'll have this in the write-up after the program, but your website is Gail Scott, G-A-I-L, Scott, Inc., I-N-C, .com. Mm-hmm. And your website talks some about how you emphasize trust.
Yes.
Trust.
And
you talk a lot about trust.
It's all about trust. And that's where, for me, I lost trust at such an early age, not just with my caregivers, but with myself. So I didn't trust myself that I would be okay if I spoke up. And that went through my entire life until I became very aware that in many situations I'd been betrayed. And then just understanding that trust was the foundation. And in many other areas of my life, after having gone through these difficult experiences, I actually took a lot of risks. I discovered that there wasn't a lot that I was fearful about. And I would make decisions, big decisions about my life, without any worry that I wouldn't be okay. And that was a huge revelation for me. Here I was making big decisions in other areas of my life, and yet in my sex life, I was holding back from being free.
Well, sure, it all kind of fits. That your self-esteem was getting better, but your sexual confidence still lagged, but it's lots better. And I think when you have sexually wounded people, we get a connection with self and self-esteem, and it often results in self-blame and loss of much of sexual identity. And so the working, I mean, I see our sexuality as pretty core to who we are, but your sexual self was so wounded, and so you were able to take risks, which probably were the first steps that you needed to take and gain some confidence, and then that it transferred into more sexual confidence ultimately with the continued work that you did. Am I more or less describing what might have happened?
That's pretty accurate, yeah.
Yeah.
I was making decisions in my life that were affecting big things going on, and kind of in the sidelines was all of this sexual growth and learning and experience and trying to understand who I was and why I was like this. And the education that I was starting to take, I would buy a book and work my way through the book doing all the exercises, which were focusing not just on my sexuality, but as you said, my confidence and my self-esteem and self-love. And about
self-love.
4 years ago, my main source of business was around self-love. Because I realized that I did not love myself, and many people don't love themselves. So I was learning how to do that and teaching other people what that was like.
And in the process, being such an inspiration because of the journey you've taken, I mean, you've been so strong and courageous and open. You stayed open. I find you amazing, Gail.
Thank you.
And that's why we're going to do a part two, I'm letting the audience know, on May 15th. We'll have Gail back to do a part two. So I'm looking at some of the notes you sent me on email. So you, besides personal success strategies, let's go into a few more of them. We've already talked about workshop seminars and buying sex toys and trying out new things out of your comfort zone to connect your body, including, well, we haven't talked about this, sensual dancing, striptease, tantra healing practices, meditation. So those things are really good. I mean, dancing is such, and doing a striptease for your partner, and you now, I mean, happy ending here, you've got a sexual partner. I'm so happy about that. But doing, for instance, doing a striptease for your partner can be exciting. It can help you get in the mood because you're moving your body. And then you see the desire, hopefully, in his eyes. So I think, and moving, yeah. How is striptease for you? And have you put it into practice with a partner?
I've not done a full striptease with a partner yet.
Yeah.
Only because
okay.
I've met this new man in my life now, and mm-hmm. we're exploring all kinds of different things.
Yeah.
But I have danced for him, and I have done lots of different things kind of related to that. And what I find is that as much as I feel uncomfortable with anything, I've gone through so much of feeling uncomfortable about learning new things mm-hmm. that I just bowl on in and do it anyway. and sometimes I will say things like, oh my gosh, I feel really uncomfortable doing this, or I'm very self-conscious, or I'll giggle, sometimes I'll cry. I find that the more I put myself out there in my relationship, the deeper our connection is, the better we communicate, the better the sex is.
Yeah.
It's just a wonderful experience. And mm-hmm. dropping the idea that sex is bad or wrong or dirty or shameful, mm-hmm. because that was my past. And I don't want that to be my future. I see it as a beautiful thing.
Which leads us to another point on your success strategies that you tried and are currently using. And you say forgiving myself for earlier choices and learning how to drop shame and guilt around being a sexual woman. I would add to that, and based on my experience working with clients, confusion, shame, guilt, confusion.
A lot of that.
Yes.
There's a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in an environment where I was objectified by other men within my mm-hmm. parents' business.
What was their business, by the way, if you don't mind?
They owned a bar.
Okay.
Yeah. And so there were men in the bar,
yeah.
And I was working in the bar. I was, you know, in and around that establishment, and I'm a teenager.
Right.
So I'm developing and I'm learning about who I am, and there was a lot of sexuality comments and actions that would happen to me, and me not understanding that sexuality is really a beautiful thing between people who love each other and care about each other, and experiencing it and seeing in my mind that, oh, this is the way you relate to men as a young woman. This is how it works, and this is what I do, and this is how men love me. And so that was extremely difficult to get past further down the road as I ended my marriage and then went out to date. I would always be thinking about, oh, they only want one thing, or, you know, anybody who would make a pass at me, I would immediately go to, well, what's going to happen next? And so my spidey senses were up, as they say, and really understanding that I'm allowed to be sexual, and I'm allowed to feel good about it, and it's not always objectification, and it's not shameful, and forgiving myself for the decisions that I'd made back then, the beliefs that I'd carried with me for so long, and it was almost as if I didn't even see men as just regular human beings. And I remember an experience in my coaching training where I did a very intimate experience, a verbal experience with another coach, and for the first time I saw him just as a human being in front of me, and not a man with a mission or a man with something on his mind. And that was really, really eye-opening for me.
Liberating.
Yes, and then to go into myself and love myself despite what I'd done, because I had then used sex or, you know, the clothes I wore or the way I moved or the way I flirted or the way I talked with men over the years to get attention, to get love, to get approval. And that was a revelation for me to see that about myself. Oh, my gosh, that's very manipulative. That's very controlling. Who am I? I don't want to be like that. I want to be free. And that was huge for me to go through that.
Of course it was. Of course it was. Huge and transformative.
Yeah. I say to people, you know, I've reinvented myself from the inside out at a cellular level. I feel like I was reborn in my 40s with all of this work that I've done, and I feel passionate about bringing other people to a place of acceptance and love about themselves and all their relationships, and seeing how our patterns create a reality in our current lives, and especially for children too.
Yeah, one of the things you said was learning that you had to learn how to have open and honest conversations with your daughters about sex.
Well, that was very new because I grew up in a family where there were three rules: don't trust, don't talk, don't feel. Those are the three rules coming out of dysfunctional, addictive families.
Yeah.
And so when I went through my separation, my daughters weren't even teenagers at that point, and I was almost discovering who I was as a woman. And so we went through a bit of a tumultuous time as I kind of swung out to going back to being 17 and going out dancing and wearing, I had a great figure at the time, I still do, but I was wearing, you know, more provocative clothing and dating and things like that, and they were just kind of blossoming into adolescence, and I didn't really know what I was doing. And so over the years, I've had to learn how to have these open and honest conversations with my daughters, and it's transformed my relationship with myself and with them in a way that is beautiful now. I believe that we have really open, trusting, you know, relationships where they can talk to me about stuff, and Yeah, they have their own things that they keep to themselves, I'm sure. You know, not everybody tells their mom everything, but I know that they know that if there's something they want to know about, they can come to me, and I'm not embarrassed about it, and I'm able to talk to them. And I've had to tell them some pretty heavy-duty information.
Were you able to explain to them that because of your history, you almost needed to go back to your 17-year-old self since you hadn't really been able to experience her fully?
It's funny. I ended up having some fairly in-depth conversations, especially with my oldest daughter, about what had happened to me and who I had been being and why I had done what I had done. Because for her, it was very upsetting because all of a sudden she had this one mom and now she had this new mom, and she was going through her own, you know, growing up process. And yes, it was, I had to explain some things to both of them, but they, I remember once saying to them, you know, I'm so, so sorry for some of the things I've done and the way I've been, and my older daughter looking at me and saying, it's okay, Mom. And I said, no, it's not okay. And she said, it is, you're not like that anymore.
Well, and I'm going to guess, Gail, that you were a very good mother. And they were, when they were little babies, and you probably were attentive and gave them secure attachment. You know about attachment theory a little bit?
I did, and in many respects, because of the dysfunctional relationship with my own mom, I was probably more attentive as a mother. I was determined to be the best mom I could be.
Yeah.
In some senses, I lost myself in that process, but then as I moved through these changes, I became a lot more secure in myself, and so was able to really love them for who they were and teach them, as I was learning myself, things with humility about what I didn't know, and sometimes saying things like, well, I don't have all the answers to that, but we'll find out and we'll figure it out and it's all going to be fine. And I'm here and you can come to me with anything.
That is fabulous that you did that. You know, in the past I've talked to OPTAs and parents wanting to know how to talk to their children about sex. And I'll say, you need to say, I may not have all the answers to your kids if they ask a difficult question, but, you know, I'll look it up and we'll revisit this. And that's so good because it conveys that you are still open and receptive, but you know, you might even be learning something together.
Well, what happened for me was that because I was going to these workshops and reading books and learning about everything, I would find age-appropriate material available to me for them. And so I would buy a book or, you know, find a website, and then I would give it to them. And I think that sometimes they thought I was over the top, but I really wanted them to understand themselves and their bodies, and what sex was about. And in fact, my children's friends knew that I was someone who openly talked about sex. And I would find their friends talking to me about stuff. And sometimes my daughters would be sitting there wishing that we weren't having that conversation.
I know. Yeah, it's deeply embarrassing. My children went through that in high school with me, their mother, a sex therapist. But it is, it's knowledge is power, and you know, I think we really need to talk to our kids, talk to them. Silence is a message, and good for you that that you were able to be so open and that your daughter's friends knew that.
And it's really created a forum, especially in my life, not just with my kids, but in my life when I talk with people, because I've been able to deal with forgiving myself for the shame and guilt and of what the decisions I've made and the things I've experienced, that I will talk about sex quite openly with anyone that happens to be in the conversation. And I know I've seen on people's faces things like, did she really just say that? Did she say that word? I can't believe she said that word.
Well, they're always going to be traditional folks, conservative folks, prudish folks in the crowd. And I've sure experienced this a lot in my life, and I the way I've worked it is that I try, and I'm not always successful, but I try not to talk about sex unless I'm asked.
Yes, I so understand that.
In social situations, at least.
Yes, and I don't bring it up unless I have people who are asking. And I certainly don't bring up my history because for a lot of people, and what it's very difficult for them to hear. I've shared my story with certain people, and people start crying.
Yeah,
and
I've
done
it
the work, so I don't cry anymore.
Right.
Well, not much. But
yes.
And so I realize with that it's a huge impact it has on people about how traumatic and painful it's been.
You know, even when we spoke yesterday, you know, I've heard thousands of stories over the 35 years I've been doing this work, but when you told me that your molestation started at age 9 with your father and continued to intercourse at age 13, ending at age 16, I don't know if you heard me, but I kind of gasped. I just, I felt so much for you, dear Gail. I mean, that just was a huge, huge trauma. But you have emerged. You've emerged stronger and more self-aware, and you didn't get sucked to the bottom by all of this.
I know. I find that kind of unbelievable myself. I've never, ever been in a place of victim around this. Never.
So how do you account for that? Because that's, 'cause most people with your kind of history definitely assume a victim mantle, and it actually inhibits their lives because they're often in stasis.
It's an interesting phenomenon.
I'm a victim, and so I can't move forward, kind of thing.
Yeah, I've never felt that. The one thing that was big for me was that it was very clear to me at the very beginning of all of my work that I was here for my children, that I have two daughters and they need me. And at a very, very low point in my life, early on when I discovered the background of family that I came from and what it had done to me, I was ready to just end it all because the pain was so intense. I was so depressed. And I got a very clear message in my mind as I, you know, thought about it seriously. No, you've two girls to take care of, and they need you, and you need to stick around for that. So that was the first thing. And the second thing was that, you know, they say God doesn't give you any more than you can handle.
Yeah.
And in all the work that I'd done prior to the repressed memory of the incest, that, I think, stood me in such good stead. Because when I got that information, you know, 5 years ago, I had done a ton of personal work to get to be in a fairly good place. And the sexuality that I had been exploring had been kind of just happening gradually, but consistently. And so I just had this don't know what it was, just this thing inside of me that said, there's a reason. There's a reason for this. There's no accidents, and this is a gift. And you will use this to help someone else down the road. And so, like I said before, I just kept putting one foot in front of the other, and I just kept healing more and more in lots of different ways. And I thought, I deserve to have a good sex life. I deserve to have a great life.
Hey, there's what I like to hear.
So I just kept pushing because that's really what I wanted. And what I have now is so out with the realms of what I thought was possible. It's just, my life is so unbelievably fantastic.
I'm just in awe of you, Gail, because I've worked with so many people that would have just folded up their tents, you know,
yeah,
with a history like yours. I mean, usually if they stay with me in counseling, they don't, because I don't tolerate a victim mentality very well. You know, I just, come on now, we can do better.
Mm-hmm.
And
I don't know.
And yet I'm empathic,
never, it was never
of
there.
Course. What?
It was just never there.
Yeah.
The victim was just never there. It just, mm-hmm. I don't know why. I can't, it must be some spiritual thing. I have no idea. I just,
yes,
kept,
I bet it is
forward.
Some spiritual thing.
Yeah.
Is your spiritual life fairly lively?
Oh, very. I am
good.
A very, very spiritual person. And it's developed over, definitely over the decade, but more so in the last 2 or 3 years, where I've really, really connected to this divine mission that I have to help people with trust and betrayal, with their relationships. And I'm very intuitively connected with an inner knowing that, you know, we call intuition. And I just know things, and I trust things, and I trust myself now, and it really guides me on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, I'm going to guess that you are intuitive, bordering on psychic.
Intuitive and psychic, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes, and that's been quite the revelation as well, to discover
mm-hmm.
that part of myself, but it is definitely in place now. And again, that's a whole other conversation about how that's developed over the years.
And
in ways
maybe,
that I would never have imagined.
And perhaps you'll be willing to share that when we speak again on May 15th.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And that comes into the tantric work that I like
yeah.
to teach and write about and talk about, because I believe that the divine is in everyone. Love, we are all love, we're all connected, we're all the same. And when we connect at that spiritual, deep, conscious level, our lives are profoundly different in the way that we experience people and ourselves. And it's quite magical.
And in the list that you gave me of your personal success strategies, you say learning about the tantric lifestyle and how it can expand your sexual pleasure and the use of sexual energy
mm-hmm.
and slowing down sex
Ugh.
And focusing on the senses and the sensuality. So I want for this to be a focus piece of our part two discussion.
I would love to talk about that.
There's a lot about that. But you are such a deep person. Like you've practiced as part of your healing self-expression, including erotic poetry and writing about
yes.
your sexual experiences, asking for what you want and need sexually, including stopping during sex to talk about what's happening for you. All of that's
yes.
very healthy. But erotic poetry, we have just a couple more minutes, or maybe three. Erotic poetry, can you talk about that?
Sure, I'd love to. I was introduced to erotic poetry by a man here in Toronto by the name of Dwayne Morgan, and he was on a Sex with Dr. Zen TV show that I was being interviewed on, and he was being interviewed as well, and he gave a tiny little snippet of his erotic poetry that he does. And so he and I connected after the show, and we were talking, and I said to him, tell me more, and he said, well, why don't you write some?
Uh-huh.
And I looked at him like he was crazy. Why would I do that? And then, lo and behold, I guess in my intuition, I got guided to write, and I just felt drawn to write some things. And so I was able to just create this erotic poetry out of my own experiences and my own fantasies and desires. And it was very rich and rewarding for me. And I love it. I've written 10 different poems now. I would like to write probably another 10 more and publish them. And they are, some of them are fun. Some of them are serious. They're all erotic. And it's
and,
just
and
a
will
great
you promise
creative
to send me one or
outlet.
Two before our next show?
Pardon?
Would you send me one or two of your erotic poems before our next show?
Sure.
Great.
Sure, I'd love to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've read them. I've read them at speaking events that I've done.
Yeah.
I've read them with people who, you know, I'm in a relationship with, and I see it as fun.
Sure.
I see it as fun.
And we can express so much through poetry that can't be expressed any other way. Gail, you are a delight.
Thank
and
you.
An inspiration. And when we speak again, here comes the music. We're going to talk more about everything. Thank you, Gail.
Wonderful. Thank you
and
so much for the conversation.
You're welcome.
It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Take good care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Nell'abirinto di un amaro autore. Ma i tuoi piedi in casa.